It feels like it was in a different century. It certainly was a different year when I spoke with Theodor Jager, the leading South African agricultural spokesperson. And he was warning that the foot and mouth disease was starting to get out of control. He was very unhappy at the reaction by government at the time. And now, well, a few weeks later, it's got to crisis proportions. We hear, and we'll get more in this discussion, that it's the worst hit that livestock farmers have taken since the Rinderpest in 1897. A catastrophe for livestock farmers, a catastrophe for South Africa. And what's going to happen? How can they fix it? We'll find out later. Emma Nyland is with Intellect. Emma, good to be talking with you. Just perhaps give us a little bit of background what Intellect is.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having us here today. Intellect is a consulting firm from New Zealand. We've got the franchise in South Africa, and we analyze farmers' businesses, look at their financial performance as well as physical performance, run study groups and benchmarking, and help them become more profitable.
And the foot and mouth disease hasn't really hit the public consciousness to the degree that one might have expected. What has it done to the farmers' balance sheets and income statements?
Alec, it has been absolutely catastrophic. You can't imagine it until you see it. We've got many of our farmers that have had outbreaks since June of this last year, and hundreds are really battling at the moment. It is flying through the country, and the costs are ramping up. Medical costs are going up massively, and income's dropping because their milk can halve. It can go down 70% for the month, and a whole lot of animals are being culled out the system. On average, we've seen that the cost that we're losing per animal is about 4,000 to 6,000 rand per animal in herd, which is catastrophic. It's something that farmers can't carry. And some of our farmers haven't just been hit once, but they're on the second or third outbreak already.
So just explain to us why foot and mouth disease would be so impactful for a farming community.
Alec, it's not just about the cost of the medicine, which is massive, but our beef farmers, they can't sell their weaners. So they're sitting with animals that they're having to feed and they can't sell. They've got calves dying. Our dairy farmers, the mastitis is so severe that they're having to kill a whole bunch of their cows, calves. They're just not pulling through. And so from a disease perspective, the mortalities are massive, the medical costs are huge, and the labor and staff are really, really battling with the hours that they're having to work, looking after these animals. And it's such a animal cruelty issue that is not being seen. And our people are having to work with this, and the depression is massive. And I think food prices are going to go through the roof if we don't do something about it.
Just explain that, animal cruelty, how that comes into play.
Alec, we're seeing animals that cannot eat, they cannot walk. Their udders are exploding. When we're having to milk them out so that they don't die, but the milking machine is stripping the skin off their teats. There are blisters inside the teat canals that are having to be opened before the milk can come out. And it looks like a war zone. There are animals lying around the dairy. They cannot move. They cannot eat. Skin is coming off their tongues. It's really just catastrophic. And without the vaccine, we're not going to be able to get any better.
So you said the vaccine. Explain where that situation is.
Alec, currently, foot and mouth is a state-controlled disease, so only state can provide us with vaccines. We are currently getting vaccines in from Botswana, the BVI vaccine, but there are just not enough coming into the country. And they were only injecting animals once they were already clinically sick. And that's not how a vaccine works. It needs time to run its course to get the immune system of the cows up, but they were injecting them too late. And because there aren't enough in the country, it's a bun fight on who gets it. Steenhuisen has said that he will be bringing in 1 million doses a month, which is still not enough. There's a debate on how many animals we've got in the country, but the high end of it is about 14 million. And we're needing about 56 million doses coming in the year to cover that, because they're having to be boosted every 3 months. And there is just no vaccine around, unfortunately.
can the vaccines not be sourced from other countries or other parts of the world by farmers to protect their herds?
Currently, we need Dr. Maja to sign off on that. She is the director of animal health, and only the director of animal health can sign off on that. So if we can send bloods to Purbright and viral match to other vaccines that the rest of the world can create for us, then yes. But we need Maja to sign off on that, and we need her permission.
So how do you mean she has to sign off on every single farmer's application?
The state would have to do it, or an organization would have to do it. So the lab would need the Section 21 signed, which Maja has refused to do. There are some vaccines in Turkey that the MPO were trying to bring in, and that was supposed to be signed in December, and it has not been done. So farmers don't have any control over it, unfortunately.
So how big a crisis is this? We're going to be talking to Pete Keane in just a moment. He says it's the worst since the Rinderpest in 1897. Is it that bad?
It's catastrophic, Alec. I've only been in the industry for 10 years, but it's the worst thing that I've seen since I've been in the industry. And Andy Landau-Vett would be able to tell you more, and Pete will tell you more. But it's absolutely catastrophic, and you can't imagine it until you see it.
Let's bring Pete Keane in now. He is a farmer in KZN and one of the, well, I suppose up until now, one of the most successful farmers in the KZN Midlands. Pete, from your perspective, you're living with us every day. When did it start to affect your operation?
Alec, good morning to you and to the listeners. I farm in quite a wide area of geographic zones, and it's been going for quite a long time. I do spend quite a lot of time helping emerging farmers. So that's the first point I must make. And they affected a lot worse than what we are as commercial farmers, because they rely on the state and there are very few mechanisms to protect their interest, and they rely on animals for school fees now in January. They can't sell animals, and they keep animals basically for 12 months to sell in December for Christmas and again in January for school fees. So that's our first concern, that the moment that whole, and there are a lot of emerging farmers that are not looked after well enough in this regard. The commercial farmers, Emma's told you about, the beef farmers, we haven't seen anything yet. So it's affected some beef farmers, lost 200-300 calves. We've seen pictures on social media about them throwing them away in pits and just dumping them in wherever they can. But the psychological issues, the animal welfare issues that Andy will talk about, how does one put a cost to those things? But your question was, how's it affected us? It's affected us a lot. We cannot sell animals. It's the same as one would say to ShopRite or one of those big supermarket chains. You may not sell anything for 3 months, and we will then, as government, decide whether you can sell after 3 months, and maybe we might decide you won't sell for 6 months. So this is the danger and this is why we're talking about these issues, because this is the danger about putting controls. And the moment that the issue is like this, the first reaction is to put a policing state in place and controls in place. But no business can survive without selling anything for 6 months. That's what farmers do. That is the business. So we've got to bring attention to that. And the only way to get around that is to make sure that vaccines are available. And 56 million vaccines need to be made or made accessible to farmers. We buy vaccines every day. And I've got a costing here. I've done all my cattle for all the rest of them, so they're not opportunistic diseases coming in, such as Pastorella, all the rest of Pastorella, Covaxin for Clostridias, and to cover those animals from getting secondary diseases when they do get the foot and mouth. But we've got the worst still to come. When winter hits, all those emerging farmers, they haven't got food reserves, they haven't got money reserves, and those animals are going to die on sow fault areas. To date, it's been mainly in dairies, in feedlots, and in sweet felt areas with a good rain season. So our foreseeable sort of vision on this is that we better act quickly. Time is our enemy.
So what I understand is that it is endemic to South Africa because we have the buffaloes. This is what Theodore Yager told us. He said the buffaloes have got foot and mouth disease. Donkeys have got foot and mouth disease. And they then will spread it if it is not confined to certain areas. And for decades, it was kept. There was a buffer around the Kruger Park being an obvious source. But that buffer was then breached and no longer enforced. You're a long way from the Kruger Park. How long did it take to get to you, and did you see it creeping up?
Look, yeah. So we dealt with this from February. I've been in contact with the authorities, and February, June, I sent them a letter stating what has to be done. But we're unique in this country with certain dynamics. So basically, I can get on a horse and I can ride from the highway, Durban-Joburg Highway, pretty much to the coast without going through a fence other than maybe a game fence for other side of the N2. So animals can move. We've got buffalo, which will be a burning ember, a source of infection. All the disease-free buffalo herds around the country will no longer be so. They'll be a bit sort of sources of reinfection. So the only way that we can do this is make sure that vaccines are available. And the laws have changed. So the law was from 1984, and it hasn't been updated. CA, which is brucellosis, falls under exactly the same law. So I think it's Act 54, 1984. So it falls under exactly the same thing. Farmers can walk into any co-op, any business that supplies those things, get a print out of the cold chain, and say, I want that vaccine, or I don't want it because the cold chain's been breached. You cannot do that with a government vaccine. They won't give you a cold chain report. So, and vaccines are 10 rand. So the first thing they've got to do is, I'm not a vet. I'm not a scientist. I'm a simple farmer. So all that I want to know is, can I get that vaccine into my car when I need it? Can I walk into anywhere and buy it? As I do with CA and brucellosis, there are two strains of brucellosis, RB51, S19. You can buy them anywhere and you can put it in. So it falls under exactly the same act. So this is equivalent to a fire in someone's house. So if the viewers are watching, if you've got a fire in your house, the vaccine is equivalent to the water in that fire. So to understand it, if you have a fire there, you have to call the government and notify them that you've got a fire. So they will then send someone out if it's not weekend or Christmas or not on leave, and they have been to another fire in the last 7 days because it's contagious. They will then come and have a look maybe 2 or 3 days later and say, well, we'll send some water and we'll find someone to supply the water. About 7 days later, they might come back to you and say, okay, we're sending some water and you'll have to pay for it. That is the analogy that I use to compare the way that foot and mouth is administered today. And the reason for the carnage that we're seeing, the economic loss, the psychological issues, and the threat to food security.
So let me just understand this. Because it's a government-designated disease, or the government controls it, you can't, to use your analogy, take a bucket of water and throw it on the fire because, well, you can't get the water because the government won't let you access it. Is that the way we're looking at it? You can't get hold of the vaccine to vaccinate your herd.
And I think that is one point. But the main point in that regard, if you do put water on the fire, legislation states that they will be able to prosecute you. And there have been organizations that have been calling for that.
So explain that. Explain that to me. How do you deal with it then right now? You've got lots of cattle. Your cattle are getting foot and mouth disease. That means that they're getting sick. You can't sell them. Some are going to die through starvation. What can you do? Can you, as a private sector farmer?
Alec, as a law-abiding citizen in this country, there's nothing you can do except go onto these kind of things where it can be brought to the public's attention. Hopefully, the politicians take some notice, the civil service takes some notice, and the world takes some notice. But at this stage, it's a raging fire. Nobody can do anything about it. You've got to wait till the whole country is black and burnt to the ground, and then start with a whole lot of protocols that are not really that wouldn't have been necessary. And I must mention that red zones, foot and mouth fences. They're non-existent, as you state, anymore. But here's the thing. It's such a contradiction, because the moment that you have zoning, you have price disparity. And the moment you have price disparity under our current, dynamics in this country. And one's got to remember that people need money to survive, and livestock are a business. So the moment that you put too many restrictions, you're curtailing their business and their income. So the moment you've got price disparity, you're encouraging people to find the market with the best price. And that is the area that is now foot and mouth free. So what you're doing is encouraging animals to go from a foot and mouth area where the price is low or unsellable, to move them through all the mechanisms and state controls to an area where you can sell them for a better price. So in short, red zones, zoning, etc., they work in Brazil because you've got 200 million head of cattle. They've got a zone. In this country, nobody even knows how many cattle there are. I mean, at one stage, Steen hasn't mentioned a figure of 7.2 million. Somebody else mentioned 9 million. Somebody else mentioned, Theodore talked about 14 million. So the only way that we can do it, I've sent them a six-point plan. We've got all these vets that are on Zorma year or on the working year of training of vets. Send them to the labs. Go and buy a share in them. We need 56 million doses of vaccine to get this thing under control. And that's before you start on the pigs and the buffalo.
I spoke to John Steenhuisen last year, towards the end of last year, about something different, and then brought in this question about the foot and mouth disease and what he was doing about it. And he was quite confident that it was under control and that they knew what they were up to. From what you're telling me now, he might actually need to bone up on his information and certainly on his actions.
Alec, the farmers have got no power under the current legislation to look after their own goods and their own livelihoods. So by the same token, the state must be responsible for their losses, because we're in the state's hands. And Minister Steenhuisen has admitted that they failed dismally in controlling this disease, which means they failed the farmers. This now makes the state responsible. So here's the thing. To vaccinate the whole herd, call it 25 rand a dose, at 56 million doses, you can do the sums, just over R1 billion. Well, they spend that much on a commission of inquiry. And at the end of this, typically in this country, we have commissions of inquiry, and that money will be spent on that. They might as well cut to the chase, set up labs. I should be able to phone a lab who does these kind of things and say, make me 1,000 doses or 10,000 or 5, whatever number of cattle I've got. I need it for this, and I need somebody for the emerging farmers to help them look after themselves, because the government has dropped the ball.
Just explain what you would do if you had John Steenhuisen coming to your farm and you could show him what you see on a day-to-day basis. Give us a bit of the experience that perhaps you could show this Minister of Agriculture so he can really understand what's going on.
Well, firstly, I wouldn't be able to offer him a cup of tea because I can't afford it, because I haven't sold animals for 2 months. And I probably won't sell animals for another 3 or 4 months because of this disease. So think about the emerging farmers who kept animals for a year. They're now dying, the animals, and they kept them for December to get something for Christmas. They run stock fells. There's a whole lot of dynamics in this country that has got nothing to do with science, biology, or veterinary knowledge. And this is the issue in this country, that everybody's run to control and this science and biological knowledge, which one's got to emphasize this point. Vaccines must be safe. You can't compromise on that one. So that's the first thing. The second thing, we've got the best farmers, some of the best farmers, and we've got the best vets in the world. So those points are not the domain of today's discussion. What is, to answer your question, so I would say to him, go back, change the legislation. I want to walk into the shop, I buy all my vaccines from 3 or 4 different outlets, I phone them there for, I say, give me a print out on your cold chain. If the cold chain has kept it the right thing, I go in and say, give me 2,000, 10,000 doses, whatever I need. I take it home and I put the vaccine in my fridge, including the other state-controlled disease under the same act, which is CA. I do it myself. So what is the difference between this and the other one? That's the question I'd ask him. And to say, well, how are you now going to support us because the state has made such a mess? and won't change the legislation. I do understand the process and the procurement process of all these things. And I've engaged with them in the past about that through various means. And the answers didn't satisfy me.
The interesting part about all of this is if it is a state-managed disease and you can't really do much about it except wait for, as you said, just wait for basically to go bankrupt, is there not a legal case to be made against the state? Perhaps that, when there's money involved, that will capture people's attention. What do your lawyers say about this?
Well, Eric, I'm not a lawyer. And we obviously everybody's got legal advice. But here's the thing, that one's got to look after one's business and concentrate on what you do. So we're so busy looking after our animals and after our neighbors' animals and everybody else. And as I say, particularly emerging farmers who've been left in the lurch. I think at the end it's going to probably be a class action suit. That's my uninformed, and it's a guess. I've no legal knowledge, but here's the thing. It's a 1984 law. As far as I know, the Constitution was drawn up 10-odd years later. So it's tantamount to be standing in my kraal and saying, well, do I let you all die and suffer, which breaks anybody's heart? And I, quite honestly, I don't think I'd take it psychologically. Or do I perhaps fight this thing? And I think the only option they leave us is to fight it. Because once this goes through, people think it's a foot and mouth disease that goes through and leaves us alone. In other words, a fire that's burned your farm, it's gone through, it can't do any worse. It can. It comes back in a second one, and a third wave, and a fourth wave. And don't forget, the burning embers in this country. Our dynamics are that's the way it is in this country. The communal areas, there's just too many factors that affect the spread of foot and mouth. And you don't have to know anything about veterinary or biology or about viruses or bacteria or any of those things. All you've got to know is that this disease spreads. And if you haven't vaccinated, you're going to get caught.
How significant is the livestock that you have, your farming operation?
Well, Eric, it's like asking someone how much money they've got in the bank. Our livestock is our asset. So I can't even tell you that because I don't even know tomorrow whether I'll have any money in the bank. In other words, I don't know how many livestock that I'll have. So, I think every other farm in the rely on their livestock to stay alive and pay taxes, by the way.
Yeah, what I'm trying to get at is what percentage of your herd has now got foot and mouth disease?
Alexa, so as of today, it's been through 100% of the herd.
And do they recover?
That's something I can't work out, and the vets know better than I do. But my observation is, and it's over a very wide area, some animals get 90% affected and none die. They show symptoms of it, and they might succumb to some other secondary infection because their immunity is down. And other herds might show 20% infection rates, and you'll get, of those 20%, you'll get 90% that die. And then the neighboring herd right next door will have 350 calves in his one herd, and 300 of them will die. So I can't answer that question, and I don't think any vets quite honestly can either.
It appears to be a little bit like African horse sickness in the thoroughbred industry, where if that were to go through the country, well, it would destroy the thoroughbred industry for the first part, but many, many horses would die. Is it a similar thing, and a painful death there? Is it a similar thing here with foot and mouth?
Well, Andrew will inform you on that one. He's seen far more than I have because he obviously responds to those cases. But the short answer from me is yes.
Let's bring Andy Lund in now. He is a veterinarian, also from KZN. I presume, Andy, you operate as well in the Midlands?
I do, Alec, yeah. Private practice here based in Howick. I live in Nottingham Road, and the majority of our clients are dairy, beef as well, and a certain amount in the piggeries as well. We've seen quite a massive impact on a clinical point of view on these animals. And you're asking what sort of impact. I don't know if you'll be able to see that, but basically that's an udder of a cow with foot and mouth. So a picture paints 1,000 words. That's what we're dealing with. It looks like someone's taken a blowtorch and burnt the skin off her teeth. So what follows on from that is severe mastitis. And yes, she can recover, but quite often her production has gone to zero. And that's the milk check that the farmer relies on every single month to pay his salaries, to pay his creditors, you know, running a normal business like anyone else. So the economic impact is massive. You are asking, Pete, about the mortality rates. The mortality rates vary a lot, as Pete says. It's not as much of a death sentence as African horse sickness is in horses, but we are seeing, for example, litters of piglets with 95% mortality rates. Literally out of 110 piglets, 90 are dead. And yet other animals will make an uneventful recovery, lose all the skin on their tongues, their feet, sometimes the entire hoof wall peels off. If that happens, they're walking on the bones of their legs and they have to be shot. There's no way you can fix that. So the mental impact on a farmer having to shoot his own livestock for welfare reasons on a disease that is actually preventable, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking for us as vets because we are completely hand-tied to do anything about it. As Pete and Emma said, it's a state-controlled disease. We do not have access to the vaccine. And we have people coming into our clinic desperate saying, you know, please do something. And we feel absolutely helpless to do much about it at all.
Presumably, you get called out quite a lot by the farmers to their farms. What do you encounter there usually?
So Alec, I like that picture there. But in fact, the way the protocol has to go, and again, this is the state-controlled nature of the disease, if we suspect a case of foot and mouth, we have to send the state. So the state has to go out and verify that that is foot and mouth and then put a quarantine zone around that area. That's legislation back from the 1980s. It has spread so far and wide now, that protocol is not working because by the time you get that mechanism in place, the disease has spread to the neighboring farm and to its neighboring farm and to its neighboring farm. So it's a bit like it's watching a felt fire sweep across your land and you're in no position to put a fire break and to stop that fire. You just see it just keeps coming. So the legislation is antiquated and it's not working for South Africa for whatever geopolitical reasons you can analyze until you're blue in the face.
And when you encounter the animals, how many of them are you having to put down? Well, what percentage of those who have foot and mouth disease are you having to put down because of the issues that you've raised a moment ago?
In the dairy herds, and because dairy cattle are on top of each other, you tend to have a higher culling and mortality rate. So between 5 and 10% either get culled, in other words, shot, or succumb to their secondary infections. The virus itself, funny enough, is not actually fatal. But it's all the complications that result after those blisters have burst and the skin's fallen off the teeth and the hoof walls have fallen off. So your mortality rate, as I say, varies from species to species, varies from farm to farm, but it can vary from 2 or 3% right up to 50, 60, 90% in those pigs that I was mentioning. So it's a massive variation. It's very difficult to put a single figure on it.
South Africans know a lot more about viruses given what happened here with COVID-19. Is it something that once you've had it, like with COVID, you're unlikely to get it badly in future?
No. So as Pete says, unfortunately, this disease has a very low, even if you've been exposed and recovered, your immune system doesn't seem to be able to recognize the next challenge. It just keeps recurring and recurring and recurring. And that's why it becomes endemic in countries, because unless you can stop it with a long-lasting, effective vaccine, you are not going to get on top of the disease. It'll just keep coming back at you. It's a bit like herpes virus, cold sores in people. When you're under stress, it'll flare up again. And when your immune system's taking strain, that's when foot and mouth says, hello, I'm back again.
I heard earlier in this conversation, and indeed talking to Theo de Jager, that South Africa has to get its vaccines for foot and mouth from Botswana, which seems rather strange given that this is an economy many times the size of Botswana's. What's happened here? How come we aren't manufacturing our own vaccines against this clearly very destructive disease?
Yeah, Alec, it's probably not my realm of expertise, and I don't want to get into the politics as to why Onderstepoort has failed. But essentially, that is what has happened. We were a leading vaccine manufacturer worldwide. We were exporting blue tongue vaccine to Spain. We were one of the leading producers of vaccine, including foot and mouth vaccine in the continent, certainly. And unfortunately, that has fallen apart.
So what would you be showing John Steenhuisen if you could get him to come and visit you?
I would show him a picture of that adder, first of all, because I think, as I said, a picture paints a thousand words, and talking just doesn't seem to achieve very much. And then we've got to get external pharmaceutical companies, international bodies on board to produce a vaccine that is specifically tailored to our outbreaks. And as Pete mentioned, we've got to get tissue samples sent to Pembroke in England. We've got to get that virus typed so that the vaccine can be literally tailored to our specific strain of foot and mouth. It's no good getting vaccine from Brazil. It probably won't even be effective against our strains. That hasn't been done for 20 years. We haven't submitted samples to Pembroke for over 20 years. We're supposed to, as signatories of the World Animal Health Organization, we're meant to send samples every single year, and not just for foot and mouth, for numbers of diseases. It just hasn't happened. And that's essentially how we find ourselves in the predicament we're in.
So if you don't maintain roads, you get potholes. If you don't maintain your animal health, you get outbreaks like this. But I guess the big question has to be, what can farmers do about this?
Well, the legislation has to change, Alec. We have to, the world has changed. I don't know if you remember the foot and mouth outbreak in England where they slaughtered thousands of herds. People were committing suicide, absolute carnage. The decision was taken back then. That was in the early 2000s. This would never happen again. We've got the technology to produce vaccines that doesn't require that sort of drastic measure. We just haven't kept up with the rest of the world, unfortunately.
No legislation.
And if that legislation is updated.
I guess the issue must also be for many members of the black population, their wealth is in their livestock. And they won't have them in the cities. They'll be in the country areas with family, etc. Are these animals also affected? I.e. then as a by definition, a substantial portion of the wealth of South Africans.
Yeah, absolutely, Alec. I mean, you can understand if your entire wealth is 10 animals and you are subsistence farming on 10 animals and all 10 get sick, that is a massive, massive economic impact on you. Even if all of those 10 survive, you cannot sell your animals. You have to go through designated foot and mouth abattoirs. Your price is not great. As Peter said, that's devastating for someone who's literally his entire wealth is in those animals. We've got to change the way we control this disease. And the only way we're allowed to do that, as private veterinarians, I can do nothing. The legislation has to come from government. The legislation has to change.
So I guess it's like finding somebody who you know how you could cure, taking a human being, but you're not and you know what medicine's required, but you are not allowed to administer that medicine because you actually can't get it. It's in some hospital locked up somewhere. It's similarly here with animals.
Absolutely, yeah, 100%.
Can you just explain to us, Andy, how foot and mouth affects the animal from a healthy animal to one that perhaps needs to be culled?
So the incubation period is about 7 to 14 days. We're seeing it about 8 days from time of exposure to the first symptoms developing. Most commonly, the first thing you'll see is that she starts to salivate, and that's because of blisters inside the mouth, so she's battling to swallow. Saliva gets produced on an ongoing basis. If she can't swallow, it literally just starts dribbling out of the mouth. Sometimes they'll stick their tongue out. They often go a little bit lame because of the inflammation around their hoof walls, and that lameness can get severe that they cannot stand. And then on the dairy cows, we notice blisters and ulcerating of those teats like I showed you in that picture. So that's the clinical presentation. The most common is the salivating. You see an animal, she's running a temperature, so she's standing on her own. She's not part of the herd. The ears are down. She's feeling lousy, and she's in pain. She doesn't want to eat because of all the blisters in her mouth, and she's isolated herself. But those blisters, when they burst, they're just releasing virus continuously. It's highly, highly infectious.
And what happens to the weight of the animal? Clearly, if you're in a dairy herd, you wouldn't be able to milk those cows as you would have previously. How long does it take for them to come back into being able to be productive again?
Yeah. So in a bad case, like the one I just showed you, that animal probably won't come back into milk. You cannot get that milk out, even putting local anesthetic on those teats to literally numb them so that you can milk the milk out. She will end up with severe mastitis because the teat sphincter has lost the skin on the end. So now bacteria just think it's Christmas because they can work their way up into that udder and multiply in the milk, which gives you mastitis. So that particular cow will probably be culled. Some of them will just have one or two blisters, which will heal up like any blister does in humans as well, and she'll be back in production. But when the milk drops in a cow, very seldom will it go back up to the production level she had before. So it'll come up again, but not to the same level. So the big economic impact for dairy farms is that massive loss of milk over the entire lactation, even if she makes an uneventful recovery.
And I can imagine people in the cities are not really that worried because they can still go along to Woolworths and get their milk and get their steak and their bacon. When will it start affecting their pockets?
I think the effect of that will basically be slowly progressive as this disease spreads through the country. The unfortunate thing for our local farmers is that quite often what happens then is that the importation of milk starts from European subsidized farmers. And that does no favors to our local economy in terms of agriculture, because it basically, as the milk becomes more expensive for local production, importation cuts the profit out of it. So that would be the next unfortunate effect on our farmers, is the massive importation of dairy product as our dairy product declines. I think I must... Yeah. And look, I must also emphasize that this is not a disease for humans. There is absolutely no effect on human health. The last thing we want is the message to get out there that this milk is somehow dangerous for human consumption. It's not. It's very different from hand, foot and mouth, which is a childhood disease in people. Foot and mouth in cattle has no effect on people whatsoever.
But it has an effect clearly on the animals.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, let's close off now with Pete Keane, the man on the ground, the farmer. Pete, you have mentioned earlier that, do you want to come into picture? There we go. You have mentioned earlier that you have been engaging with, or trying to anyway, with the Minister of Agriculture. If you could take over his job for one day, what would you do?
Well, firstly, I think that he took over poison chalice. So the fire has started running already. There are too many dynamics in this country that affect the decision-making of one individual. So we as farmers understand that, but unfortunately my cows do not understand that. And I think the point that you asked, Andy, about knowing someone's got a disease and you can get medicine or whatever, or medication, but you're not allowed to. I think one must expand on that further, that if you do get it, you know, falling foul of the law. That is the first one. So what would I do if I was Steenhuisen? I'd do my best and say to farmers, as he said, we failed you. You're on your own. But now we're not going to put impediments in place. Farmers are entrepreneurs, Alec. Every day a farmer gets up in the morning with a clear plan in his brain as to what work he has to do today. You don't have to put guidelines and stumbling blocks in his way, and laws. What you do have to do is take them all out of the way, and the farmer will inject his own stock. That'll take the burden away from the state. The framework for vaccination in this country and vaccines in general is excellent. They've distributed the cold chain, the logistics is all planned and done extremely well to a high standard. All you got to do is piggyback on that. So if I was Steenhuisen, I wouldn't try and reinvent any wheels. I would do my best to change the legislation to say, farmers, this is no longer state controlled to this degree. The only thing we can do now is vaccinate, vaccinate, and vaccinate. And I say that, and that's why I say there are 56 million doses to come in. Think about it. It's bringing 1 million doses a month, which is promised, plus a few rats and mice of 200,000 here and there. Well, on the third month, with that vaccine he's talking about, they're going to have to do the next animals that they started with on the first month. So it's actually four times the amount of animals that have to be vaccinated, by which time then you have to start with the next round of vaccines. So it's 100 million doses of vaccine we're talking about over 2 years. So that is the next one, to say, farmers, I'm going to make a framework, and I'll do my best to make a framework to make sure vaccines are safe. That's the first one. You've got the best vets in the world. You can now go through a channel where you can submit a sample, a blood sample, send it to any lab of your choice, and here's a list of 10 labs around the world and in this country that are done in 2 days or 3 days. I know it's a tall order, but this is the fire that's running. We've got to remember that, and it's going to come back at us. So what's got to be done is that has to be done urgently. That's the second point. So vaccine must be safe. It must be urgent. And it has to change to say, you, Alec Hogg, you've got 10 cows. You can walk into anywhere and say, either call the vet, he must do the vaccines, but there must be a framework where those vaccines are tested to make sure they're safe. That's the first one. And then secondly, anybody can get them into your car, because that's all that car is interested in, is staying alive and not suffering, because that is where our biggest problem is. The suffering of our animals is a direct result of inefficiency and inactivity. That is our biggest enemy in this instance, because it's state controlled, and our livelihoods are controlled by the state.
Pete, I'm quite interested in the aspect of the wealth, given that a big chunk of the wealth of South Africans, especially Black South Africans, is invested in livestock. I mean, that's a fact. Why has that not registered yet with the public at large, with the politicians? Because if you were raiding people's bank accounts and taking money out of their bank accounts, there'd be an uproar. Here, it's, I suppose, similar in a way, because you're not giving them the ability to protect their asset by even making those vaccines available. Why do you think that hasn't registered yet? Is it still too early in the process?
Well, Alec, we're reading one book right now. When we start going into that, we start the first page of the next book. So it's to do the same as all the rest of things. Stock theft is not reported in many cases in those communities you talk about. They'll deal with it themselves because they feel that they let down. And in the same case here, they don't want to report because the state puts controls on them, which are negative and detrimental to their livelihoods, but yet on the other hand don't assist on the other side of the coin. So it's an imbalanced reaction as far as they and us are concerned, actually.
And is there any favoritism in those vaccines that are coming in at the moment? We know a lot of politicians, including our president, have got large livestock herds.
So here's the thing, Eric. There have been vaccines that came in. I mean, the state talks about just under a million doses, but nobody really knows because the figures are all outdated and a lot of things are not reported and updated in the media coverage or correspondence is often very, very skewed. So, yeah, so I can't really answer your question.
But in your district, in the Midlands of KZN where you live, have there been many vaccines that have actually reached farmers there?
So they have been. I mean, a few MPO vaccines. They were allocated 50,000 vaccines. But here's the thing, Alec, the who's to play lord over who gets vaccines? You know, dairy farmers on the one hand, they need them. Their animals are suffering, but so too do farmers, because the dairy farmers, we're all suffering losses. So how do you allocate vaccines where they're just not enough to go around? So obviously there are dynamics in how that gets distributed and who gets it. So, but it's the dynamics. There are 20 different factors, 30 different factors in this country. I mean, things like Lobola in this country affect things that don't affect other countries. Our state procurement processes are different to other countries. There's a whole lot of dynamics in this country that affect my cow or Daisy, whether she makes it through the day tomorrow or not.
Yeah, you're right. And there's whether or not there is any fraud that's going on with the tenders, there certainly will be suspicions of it, given our history. Just to close off with, from your perspective, if I understand you correctly, you're calling for the legislation to be abolished and for farmers to be given the opportunity to source vaccines to look after their own livestock, after their own environment. Is that an accurate reading? And if that's the case, what happens to the emerging farmers who perhaps don't have those the sources of capital to be able to get those vaccines?
Eric, yeah. So in a nutshell, yes. Obviously, within certain frameworks, your first statement, I agree with it. I agree fully. The second part of the question was, what about the emerging farmers? So I think, Eric, in this thing, and we've seen it in this thing, that this emoji sign comes up on just about every single correspondence, which means one hand washes the other one. So they're all on board, and you'll be surprised at how many commercial farmers have hold hands with the emerging guys. And if they're not holding hands, all they need to do is come and say, we need some help. So that is in place already, that it's an amazing dynamic between farmers, commercial and emerging farmers. And those guys that feel that they're left out, well, all they've got to come to us and say, we need some help. And in that case, the state needs to step in and say, okay, if you can't afford it, there must be a mechanism where the state will then administer it. But at least it takes the burden off the state of doing the entire national herd.
Pete Keane, and we heard from Andy Lund and Emma Nyland, and I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.